Speed up with podcast speed up.
Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I'm your host, Julia Galef, and with me is today's guest, Dr. Vinay Prasad. Vinay is a hematologist-oncologist and an assistant professor of medicine at the Oregon Health and Sciences University. He's also the co-author, along with Dr. Adam Sifu, of the book Ending Medical Reversal, Improving Outcomes, Saving Lives. And the book treats the question of why is it so often the case that an established consensus in the field of medicine about how to treat a certain condition or a certain disease gets overturned after many years of being in use when a rigorous study shows that it has no effect or is even, in some cases, harmful? So why does that happen and what can we do about it? And that's what we're going to be talking about on today's episode. Welcome to the show, Vinay.
Thanks so much for having me.
So just to give our listeners a sense of what a medical reversal looks like, could you give an example or two of some of the big reversals in recent years?
Sure. So let me first put it a little bit in context. So I think, myself and maybe many of the listeners, I think, the way we sort of initially conceptualized medicine was, the sort of thing where for many years doctors do something and it's pretty good. It's a treatment that works. And then something comes along, a breakthrough, a discovery, and we come up with a new treatment that actually works even better. And so I think many of us have this idea that medicine is a series of what we call replacements. Something better comes along. But I think Adam and I had been noticing over the years sort of a disconcerting pattern that a bunch of the things we had recommended, that we had advocated, and we sort of tried to encourage our patients to undergo, they turned out not to be replaced by something better, but rather to be no better or worse than a prior standard of care or doing nothing. And so I think some seminal examples are, one of the things we used to do in the 1990s was for women who had passed through menopause, we would prescribe hormone therapy or those hormones that were elevated prior to menopause. And we did that with the hopes that we'd decrease cardiovascular disease. And what it turned out was in a well-done randomized controlled trial that came out in the early 2000s, what we found was we actually increased the rate of heart attacks by doing that. So here was an intervention that we thought would improve an outcome. It actually worsened that outcome. So that's one example. Another example we talk about in the book is the use of stenting for stable coronary angina. That's the kind of symptom you get when you sort of shovel the snow and it comes on, predictably with shoveling, and it happens sort of at the same frequency it's always happened, that kind of chest tightness. And, this was actually a large portion of cardiac stenting in the United States, which is the placement of a small expandable metal tube in the coronary artery to sort of open up a little blockage. And, this was a $12 billion a year industry, and patients had it done, and doctors believed that, we were saving lives. And then a well-done randomized trial showed us that actually it didn't improve survival. And it didn't decrease the risk of a future heart attack, which were two of the reasons why people thought we were having it done.
Right. And how long were each of those recommended treatments in play before the study came out showing them to be ineffective?
Yeah, so at least a decade for those two. And then, we have, many examples in the book and in some of our work. And, we find that, things that were practices that existed for, decades were contradicted. And then even things that sort of cropped up and then, were contradicted a few years later. So there's quite a range.
And can you get a handle on the relative frequency of medical reversals? Like, are the two examples you gave relatively rare, or is this how common are these cases?
I think you're asking like the first question that like the reviewers asked of us when we started doing this work, maybe in 2010. They said that you've got some great examples, but overall reversals are rare. They're like earthquakes in California. They make the news, but they don't happen all the time.
Right. And they shouldn't necessarily change the way we practice science.
Right. So that's what some people contended. And right. But I would argue that, you know, even though earthquakes are rare in California, we do have building code that, you know, meets earthquake standards. So, you know,
we are prepared. Yeah.
Right. We're prepared for rare events. But there've been a couple of ways to try to estimate the frequency of medical reversal, and we've done one of them. But I guess I can just describe the other two real quick. So, one estimate was done by the British Medical Journal, and they looked at a set of over 3,000 medical practices. And what they looked at was, of all these medical practices, 3,000 things doctors are doing day in and day out, what percent are based on really strong evidence? What percent are based on no good evidence either way? And then what percent are sort of really blatantly contradicted? And they found that probably about a third of practices were really based on robust evidence. They found about 15% of what we were doing has really been contradicted, but we haven't abandoned it. And they found about 50% of what we were doing, there's just no data for. And so, you know, with that kind of backdrop, we did an investigation several years ago, and then we expanded it a couple years later. And what we did was we looked at, all of the articles that appeared in one medical journal, the New England Journal of Medicine, in the decade. There were over 2,000 of them. We pulled out the articles that tested the standard of care. There are about 1,300 of them. We found out that, not surprisingly, the majority of articles in the New England Journal test something new. That was about 1,000 articles. But of the 300 or so articles that tested something doctors were already doing, that is already in place, we found about 40% of those articles contradicted something doctors were already doing. And so I think, you know, what we conclude from this, from these two analyses, is that, you know, if you put that 50% of things we do day in, day out that have no evidence either way, no good evidence either way, to the test, we think maybe 40% of them would fail, which is a really sizable percentage of medical practice, I think.
It's very sizable. And I notice I'm not entirely sure in what direction I expect that number to be biased, if at all. Like, are the studies, are the practices that get tested and show up in the analysis that you did, are those practices more likely to be things that are, that people have serious doubts about, and that's why they're being tested, and so they're not, they're maybe less likely to be effective than the typical practice that's in use, or are they maybe more likely to be effective because they're, you know, widely done, and that's why it's worth doing a study on them? Or something else.
I think you're kind of hitting the nail on the head. So, you know, I mentioned first, we looked at 1,000 practices were testing something new. And of that 1,000, 75% of them were positive studies. So that's the bias at play in the New England Journal, which is, if you got something new, you got to show me it's better than what we already have. That's the publication, the selection bias, I think. But if you looked at the practices that we're already doing, I would say the mere testing of a standard of care is provocative. It's the sort of thing that people want to know about, whether it's affirmative or contradictory. And we found 38% were affirmative, which really validated what we were doing, and 40% were contradictory. So it was about an even split. And so now you're saying, so is this likely to, you know, be a skewed view of the literature? And I think, you know, for the reasons you mentioned, one can imagine it's either an underestimate or an overestimate.
Right,
so it's hard
to
know. Right, yeah. So I think the true answer is, we don't know, but I think what our work has done, and then there've been a bunch of other, you know, very related projects, is to show that this is not something that happens really infrequently. This is not a solar eclipse. This is a, you know, it's a more day in, day out sort of problem in medicine.
Right. Let's go into some of the reasons why let's focus first on practices that had some evidence behind them, maybe not up to the gold standard of evidence, not at the level of the study that, you know, was ultimately done that showed them to be ineffective. But they had we had some reason for doing them other than just, you know, that's the way we've always done things. What was going wrong with that earlier body of evidence that caused this practice to seem effective when it wasn't?
Okay, yeah, that's a very good question. So I think, every single practice, whether it was contradicted or subsequently reaffirmed, they all had really sound pathophysiology. They all had sort of a biological explanation, a physiological explanation, a biochemical explanation for why something should work. So everything had that. And then on top of that, there were different layers of non-gold standard evidence, as you point out, such as, you know, some things had case series, which was sort of a doctor saying, hey, I tried this on, you know, 50 people, and this is what happened. Some things had, really carefully done historical controlled studies where doctors said, you know, we did this for 40 patients, and we compared it to the 40 patients before who we didn't do it on, and look how much better these 40 patients did. Some practices were based on observational studies, which are, you know, which often are large cohort studies where we follow, for instance, several hundred thousand nurses for several decades, and they fill out food frequency questionnaires and dietary questionnaires and medication questionnaires, and we track their, you know, different outcomes and their survival. And then we ask questions like, oh, you know, if they took hormone therapy post-menopause, was that associated with better or worse outcomes? So they're not randomized studies. They're not experiments, but they're sort of thought to be natural experiments. And we think we can control for those sort of covariates, the confounders that vary between the two groups. So there's this different hierarchy. And then I'll say, even in some cases, reversals happen because of a randomized trial. If a randomized trial is small, chooses poor endpoints as controls, and one of the biggest things we talk about in the book is a surrogate endpoint, which I think we can talk about a little bit more in a bit. And also, if randomized trials are, you know, biased in the many different ways in which a randomized trial can be skewed from the outset, where you know somebody could have sort of a thumb on the scale.
Well, let's actually, I want to double click on the problem with surrogate outcomes now. I think this is a good place for it. What is a surrogate outcome, and why is it arguably the sort of thing that we should be looking at, even if in practice that leads us astray?
So I think, a surrogate outcome is, as my co-author Adam Sifu likes to say, it's something you didn't care about until a doctor told you to care about.
That's
you
a
know,
great definition.
Like it's a great definition. So like your blood pressure or like your blood sugar or like your cholesterol level. It's something that we're taught to care about, but, if you really are honest with yourself, what do people actually care about? We care about living longer, living better. We care about avoiding heart attacks, avoiding blindness, avoiding death, avoiding disability. We don't really care about our blood sugar level. We care about it insofar as we think it predicts these other things, but we don't care about it in and of itself. If somebody told me my blood Z level was, you know, a million, I would say, I don't even know what that is, and I don't really care. A surrogate endpoint is any outcome that can be measured easily, quickly, and which we believe tracks with an outcome we actually care about. And in the history of medicine, we've done many, many studies, and we have many whole fields that rest on evidence that we can improve surrogate outcomes. We can lower blood sugar, or lower blood pressure, or lower blood cholesterol. And in some cases, we also have that evidence saying that, and it matters, and we improve outcomes people care about. In other cases, we don't have that evidence. And in a few cases, we thought we did improve a surrogate. We know we did, but it turned out we didn't improve those outcomes downstream that we actually care about.
Why might that happen? Like, why... If we do have good reason to believe that, correct me if my medical science is wrong, because I do not have a background in medicine, but I think having high blood pressure predicts, you know, likelihood of heart disease, right? Is that right?
Right.
Okay, good. Okay,
absolutely.
So going on.
Heart disease and stroke and mortality, yeah.
Right, a bunch of things that patients care about. And so if we can show that some intervention, some medicine reduces blood pressure, why would it not be the case that we could just assume from that it would reduce those, you know, likelihood of heart disease and stroke and so on?
So that's a great point. So I will say that the full answer to the question, it's not a completely solved riddle. And if it were, I think we could sort of overcome some of the deficiencies. But the real sort of root of the question is, there are a couple of ways in which we sort of prove surrogates. One is we look at different groups of people, and it does turn out that people who have naturally lower blood pressure, they have better cardiovascular outcomes than people who have naturally high blood pressure. Then the next question is, if you lower blood pressure, do you actually lower cardiovascular outcomes? And it turns out that's true for many different classes of drugs, something called a thiazide diuretic or calcium channel blockers. It wasn't so much true for a class of drugs called beta blockers. And so then you get into that, you know, why some classes of drugs, why some drugs, why not other drugs? I think it has to do with probably off-target effects.
What does that mean?
So that's one off-target effect. So yeah. That the drug may have a beneficial effect on a surrogate, but may affect the body in some other way that has a countervailing harm that's sort of such that it's a net negative. That's one possibility. Mm-hmm. Two, that the drug doesn't affect the surrogate long enough. Perhaps it affects blood pressure on a short term, but nighttime blood pressure spikes, or perhaps it's not really blood pressure that you're capturing, but blood pressure variability. I'll take an example from my own field of cancer research. we do, even to this day, two-thirds of our drug approvals are based on surrogates, and the two surrogates we use are shrinking tumors and keeping tumors from growing past an arbitrary line, 120% their smallest size. That's called progression. And those are the two surrogates that are the behind all of these cancer drug approvals. And yet, in many cases, we found that, you know, you can have a drug that shrinks tumors, but it doesn't improve survival because perhaps the cancer roars back just as fast as it, you know, was growing before. You can have a drug that delays progression, but it doesn't improve survival. And that may be because the simple fact is that progression is not measured very cleanly. It's based on the visual inspection of a tumor on a CAT scan. And we've done studies where if you give the same CAT scan to 10 different radiologists, they have 10 different opinions about whether it grew or shrank even. You know, so there's bias in the measurement. So measurement error, so off-target effects, you know, there are different ways in which the fidelity of the surrogate can be questioned, I think. But it's a very important question, and I think that the full answer in every case is not worked out. But the take-home lesson, I think, is that unless a surrogate is super well validated, and you know that's a whole sort of field of statistics in and of itself. Unless it's that level of validation, you know, we should be wary about it.
I'm also wondering how clear-cut an alleged medical reversal really is most of the time, because as you already alluded to, even if randomized controlled trials measuring the outcome we actually care about instead of a surrogate, even if those are the gold standard, they're still not perfect. And if we have a large body of a bunch of mediocre studies that all sort of suggestively point at an effect, and then we do one sort of really well done randomized controlled trial and it finds no effect, it's not clear to me that that should always cause us to update strongly towards, okay, well, this is ineffective. So, you know, how clear-cut is a medical reversal?
Yeah, so I think you're raising a good point. And there are certainly situations where, I can just think of an example that comes to the top of my mind about, you know, ways in which we ventilate patients who are critically ill. And there was a type of ventilation where we put a patient on their back and then on their front side. It's called prone ventilation. And many studies were done that didn't show a benefit. We have a recent study that shows a benefit. And it's really in this sort of murky gray zone where I think, you know, you can call for more studies, or you can sort of you can scrutinize the studies we do have, and there can be some legitimate, I think, debate. But what we found in the examples we detail, usually the pre-existing levels of evidence were super inadequate in comparison to the sort of contradictory study, the reversal study. They were you know, often orders of magnitude smaller. They were often single-center studies, which have their own inherent biases, like, you know, a very enthusiastic proponent can kind of drive results. They were not controlled in many cases. And then the randomized controlled trials were often much bigger, better controls, multi-center, double blinding, you know, all of the design features that kind of help you feel confident that you're actually, you know, testing the experimental intervention. And so, you know, I think, you know, if you look through our book, and you know, a lot of different doctors have, I think there may be a dozen sort of reversals that I think, you know, people may really want to argue about, but I think the majority of these reversals have been strong reversals in that sense. And I would say that because there's 150 reversals in the book, and so, you know, even if 10 are sort of debated.
Got it. A related question is, so having a body of evidence that consists of prior evidence that consists of a bunch of kind of mediocre studies is one, like, reason you might have a prior suspicion that a treatment works even before you do a rigorous RCT. But another reason you might have this prior suspicion is just sort of a priori reasoning or common sense, quote unquote. And this is something that I've thought about, to take a brief digression. Because I co-founded this nonprofit, and we run workshops where we try to train people in critical thinking techniques and various other kinds of rationality habits. And the hope, ultimately, like, you know, I may think that thinking rationally is an end in itself, but, you know, I'm not going to – that's just sort of a value that I happen to have. I'm not going to claim that everyone should learn rationality because it's a virtue in itself. You know, ultimately, hopefully, the goal is that it makes people, you know, more successful at things they care about and happier, and it causes them to, you know, have their behavior is better for the world in some way.
So a utilitarian justification of rationality, right?
That's – okay, I won't go too far afield because that's a whole other can of worms, but – point being, you know, there's not a lot of evidence showing that rationality training actually affects these long-term outcomes that we care about. In part because it's just very hard to do those studies, and not many people have really looked at the effects of rationality training yet. But even to the extent that it has been studied, so like we did one sort of small RCT a couple of years ago where we had like 20 people come to our workshop and 20 people, a statistically identical control group, not come to the workshop, and then we tested them before and then a year later where the treatment group had come to the workshop and the control group didn't, and we looked at a bunch of life outcomes to see if they were different. And so you might look at, say money, does learning rationality make you more effective at earning money? And you might think that should be related. It seems like it should be probably, but we found no effect. And,
and maybe like, maybe underpowered, but still.
It was a small study, but also, right. The relationship, even if it exists, I would expect it to be a noisy one. Like, I would expect there's lots of reasons, even if you become way more rational and more effective at what you do, being more productive, et cetera, maybe rationality training also causes you to decide that it's not worth it to you to slave away at a high-powered, high-earning job, and right. You want to do something more fulfilling and earn less money, et cetera. So I would expect these relationships to be hard to detect. And yet still, even though we don't have hard evidence yet, I still have this a priori assumption that probably, learning critical thinking, good decision-making skills, it's likely to have positive effects, even if we can't yet prove that.
So then here's what I would say. So I guess, so I consider myself an expert on the use of sort of clinical trials when it comes to medical claims, living longer, living better, quality of life, mortality, morbidity, and that's what our book is sort of focused around. But I think you're sort of alluding to this fact that, sort of what we're getting at when it comes to sort of how do you think about causality? How do you think about advising people and interventions? Why should that just be confined to medicine? And in fact, you see recent op-eds saying that, we need more randomization in social policy or in education research or things like that. And I think that those are sort of amenable. But I think you are kind of hitting at this idea that are there some sort of social phenomenons that it would be very difficult to even imagine, sort of a rational clinical trial, a rational trials agenda. In our book, I think we talk a lot about nutritional science as one of those places where, when you think about the breadth of different nutritional options and all of the permutations that one could have that, really making traction on sort of quote unquote an optimal diet for health, is going to be very, very difficult. And I think now you're sort of talking about, and then I guess the other thing that we've thought about a lot is, drug regulation. We have a whole bunch of rules that govern when drugs come to market, and there's this huge ongoing debate about whether or not those rules err on the side of blocking potentially promising drugs, or do they err on the side of permitting potentially harmful drugs that are ultimately useless. And, we argue about that using observational evidence, using sort of different, what I would consider non-gold standard evidence. And, one might start to imagine, well, could one, do gold standard studies in this field? And then one starts to think about, I think, all of the, the incredible difficulties in doing that. Because if you, let's say, randomized, nations to different policies on approving drugs, people may move from one nation to the next, or companies may, move from one to the other. And that doesn't quite capture, what that effect of that policy would have if it were applied sort of universally. Would companies retool their entire R&D if the bar for drug approval were higher and actually chase after drugs that have, bigger benefits? So, we can, yeah. So I think your question kind of gets at that, and it's a very deep question, and I can't answer it, I think, but I can, and I don't consider myself an expert on that field, I guess it's sort of philosophical, but, when it comes to medical questions, I do think, it's the common sense thing is a lot harder, because we've had such a history of so many good randomized trials that have really completely shredded common sense. One example we talk about in the book is, it's common sense that if a patient has multi-drug resistant bacteria on their skin, that going in the room and wearing a gown and gloves and throwing it away before you step out in the hallway, that would decrease, transmission and infections,
right.
And those kind of things.
I wouldn't even have thought to do a study to test that. It would just seem like a natural application of the basic laws of science as we understand them.
Right, exactly. And yeah, it's a natural application of the basic principles of bacterial transmission.
Yeah.
And yet it didn't improve outcomes in two randomized trials.
Wow.
So what happened, and I think what happened is when you start to live in under these policies, you may start to see, some guy came in to drop off a tray of food and he may not have worn the gown. Or a doctor wears the gown but then sits down on the bed. Or the doctor wears a gown and the stethoscope comes out and touches the patient. And so then you start to see all these holes in the system. And then you think, well, maybe the problem is patching the holes. But perhaps the hard thing is to accept the fact that maybe all the holes can't be patched, and maybe you can't even come up with an intervention that the intervention runs so counter to human nature that it can never be implemented in a way that actually improves outcomes. So that's the sort of the really pessimistic converse, I think.
Got it. How long does it take after, assuming a medical reversal is basically on the clear-cut side, as you pointed out, how long does it take for that practice to stop being used commonly in the field of medicine?
Yeah, so I guess you're alluding to this lag time that we talk about, which is, after contradiction, before abandonment. There are, we have anecdotes, like the example of stenting for stable coronary artery disease. When that was really resoundingly contradicted in 2007, there was an initial dip in the use of that procedure, but it has since sort of resumed pre-Courage levels, as before the trial. There's been one empirical investigation by John Ioannidis, who's sort of very famous in this field, and he looked at contradicted claims in the literature. One such claim was that beta carotene supplementation could prevent lung cancer. And in the 1980s, 1981, there was a really seminal observational study that suggested that would be true. But by 1993, from 91 to 93, there were sort of three randomized controlled trials that said, hey, it doesn't decrease lung cancer, that's for sure. One of the trials said it actually increases lung cancer, but at least it doesn't decrease lung cancer. And John tracked citations to the original beta carotene paper into the future. And he hypothesized that, look, if people were really heeding the contradictory evidence, they would stop citing the original paper. And he compared it against, the average citation decay curve from that same journal that same year. And he found that actually even 7-8 years afterwards, people were citing the original 81 beta carotene paper at very high rates. And he looked through those citations, and it's not decided to say, hey, look how we got it wrong. It's decided to say, look, beta-carotene still remains promising. So I think there is a lag time. It's probably around a decade. That kind of fits with our experience and these sort of, very sort of circumstantial pieces of evidence we have. And I think it kind of speaks to the fact that medical practice is a battleship, and it doesn't turn on a dime.
Right, right. Well put. We've sort of indirectly talked about the harms of medical reversal, or more to the point, the harms of having a system in which medical reversals are so common, where the harm is really the practices being used before they're reversed. But maybe let's go into a little more detail about those harms, because as you describe in the book, they do extend beyond a practice having turned out to cause direct harm to people's health.
Right. Adam and I, we try to keep it simple, and we try to, we always tend to say that the harms are really, there's three big harms of medical reversal. I think, the first harm is all of the people who underwent the practice during the years it fell in favor, they were rightly harmed. In some cases, the harm was merely opportunity cost, or they wasted some money. In some cases, they experienced the net side effects of a treatment without any countervailing benefits. The second harm has to do with the lag time you alluded to. Doctors don't change practice immediately, so future patients are harmed for, several years, even a decade, after a contradicted practice goes out of, is contradicted, but before it goes out of favor. And then the third harm is the sort of insidious harm. It's the loss of trust in the medical system. It's the harm that is a really deep harm. And we've seen it a couple of times when the United States Preventive Services Task Force flipped on their recommendation to recommend mammograms to women between the ages of 40 and 50, it created a vicious backlash. And sort of the rhetoric that was around it was, government officials want to watch people die just to save a buck. I think that's kind of the rhetoric. And I think that's, kind of misleading rhetoric, because the real reason they did that was because they felt that it doesn't save lives. It's not about the money. It's about the mere question of, does it actually work? And then we saw that with prostate cancer screening. It's not just patients who are frustrated when doctors flip-flop, it's doctors themselves. Doctors begin to, it's one thing to take the lessons of, reversal to sort of think more clearly about medical evidence. But some people, I think, misinterpret their lessons to mean something like, all of Western medicine is bad, or, everything doctors say will always be contradicted. Doesn't matter, if it's a randomized trial with 2,000 people, or if it's an observational study with 10 people historically controlled, but I think, so some people draw the wrong lessons from the problem, I think. So I think, and that's a deep problem. And, you know, I think it's only human nature. People think that doctors are, you know, maybe more objective and sort of methodical than, you know, the average person. But I don't think we're any different. We're subject to the same sorts of psychological biases. And if you've been doing something for a long time and it's made you money and you thought it did good, and it turns out that somebody tells you one day that it doesn't work, you're going to have this huge internal conflict about that, and you're going to resist changing.
Right, right. And if you've seen, you know, even a few examples in which it seemed to work, even if that's not, you know, a statistically significant result, having seen it with your own eyes, having done that with your own hands is feels more compelling than you know, reading the result of an abstract study, I find. Even for me, you know, even knowing this research, it's still, you know, intuitively more compelling.
Even for me, even talking to people who are like-minded, when I punctuate something with an anecdote about, well, let me tell you about one patient I had who had a prostate cancer screening exam and look what happened to him, you know, it has so much more resonance, even in people who have been trained to think sort of dispassionately about evidence.
Looking now at how, you know, if you had your druthers, if you were the king of the world, or the king of medicine at least, and you could, you know, reallocate the way we're doing things or the way we're spending our resources, would you, when people ask me how I would change, usually I'm talking about social science research because that's what I know more about. But the way that I always feel like I would want to change social science research is that I would take the resources we're currently spending on social science research, most of which I think is going to studies that are basically useless and that we can't really update at all from their findings because of the way they were done. And I would just reallocate it to a much, much smaller number of studies that are, you know, focused on the cases where we can actually measure the outcome we care about in the real world, like how people make, you know, purchasing choices, say, in the real world, as opposed to in a game that economists set up in a lab at a university with undergrads,
right.
And, you know, limit ourselves to studies that are sort of as long-term as we need them to be, that have a control group and all those good things. And those would certainly be more expensive, and also there would be fewer cases in which they would even be possible, but at least
they would
those
be more
studies.
Informative.
Exactly.
Right.
And and I feel like overall we'd still be able to update much more from that tiny group of well-done studies than from the, you know, giant group of studies that are currently being done with the same resources. So I'm wondering if that is something you would endorse as a change for to deal with the problem of medical reversal as well, or if not, what you would recommend.
So I think that is a perfect analogy to the situation we have with new drugs, where we do clinical studies for idealized efficacy, where we take people who are perfect otherwise than, you know, the disease in question. They have no other comorbidities. They have no other medical problems. They're not on any medication. We give them the drug under really idealized circumstances. You know, we carefully monitor them. They're often, you know, decades younger than the average person with their problem, you know, especially in cancer. And we ask if the drug actually improves survival or something like that.
Right.
And that's what it takes to get approved. And, you know, I've been a big proponent for that's the wrong way, because who, you know, the question is, you know, once the drug is approved and we're giving it to people who are 10 years older and have real comorbidities, does it work the same way if it has only a marginal benefit in an idealized? So I, you know, we call it a clinical effectiveness research, or research that actually informs the real world. So I think I'm a big proponent of that. And I think, as you mentioned, it may cost more, but its conclusions will actually have real world implications rather than, you know, idealized implications that, you know, speak to no one. But I guess I would say that, you know, the deep way, you know, if I were sort of king of medicine, of course, heavy is the head that wears the crown, but what I would do is, I mean, if we just look at the way we spend our resources, we're spending, you know, $700 billion a year in Medicare spending on healthcare. We're spending probably an additional several hundred billion dollars a year. I mean, you know, we're well over $1 trillion in healthcare spending, you know, 20% of GDP. And what percent do we spend on research? You know, the NIH has a budget of $30 billion, and clinical research or clinical trial research is just a fraction of that $30 billion. I think we're spending, you know, at most 2% of what we spend on healthcare in knowing whether or not the healthcare actually works. And I think I would dramatically shift that. I think, you know, the percent of healthcare spending that should be, you know, as long as we live in an era where so much of medicine is untested, the percent of medical spending that should be on testing it should be, you know, at least 15%, 10%, 5%. I'll settle for 5%, you know, but it should be much more. Clinical trials should be pragmatic, which I think is exactly what, you know, you sort of alluded to, and kind of my frustration with social science research too is, yeah, people play a video game in a laboratory, but what does that tell you about, you know, real world interactions? And the same thing in medicine. You know, people who are 40 years old with metastatic colon cancer, you know, they do well on they improve survival by 1 month with some, you know, new pill with medium toxicity. But when you take that pill and you give it to the average patient who's 75 with colon cancer and who's gotten heart medication and liver medication, heart medication, cholesterol medication, and other medications, and that person has way more side effects, and they may not even get that 1 month at the end. And there's very rarely a trial that informs our practice for those patients. I think so we should have that switch. And then I guess, you know, we can talk about it more. But, you know, in the book, we also talk about sort of deeper ways we can try to tackle this problem, you know, reforming medical education, how we train doctors, reforming how we promote professors, reforming the drug and device approval process, and also trying to reform an ethic among people who practice medicine to demand better evidence.
So a lot of things I want to double click on there. But first, there was you just alluded to something, a point I was particularly struck by in your book, which you treat briefly, but it really hit home for me, which is that the focus in medical education and I guess probably also in pre-med programs on the science behind the medicine, like the organic chemistry, for example, probably physics as well. They have to take physics, I think.
That
primes people to be to be compelled by or to be focused on the wrong kind of evidence. Can you
Absolutely.
Elaborate on that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we do kind of toss it out there. And to some degree, it's a hypothesis. So, I'm not going to say that I've proven this. But, you know, I think there is this sort of dangerous cognitive fallacy that happens in medical training, which is that the entire first 2 years, you're taught about the mechanism by which a drug will exert action. You're taught that, you know, the drug will go and bind this particular receptor in the brain or in the kidney. It will interdict the function. It will downregulate the downstream protein. It will cause an upregulation of this other protein. And that should reverse sort of what we're seeing. And you see that when students come out of the classroom and they start going on to the wards, you ask them questions like, you know, why do we prescribe an ACE inhibitor for patients with heart failure? And they start to tell you about angiotensin II and downstream TGF-beta signaling and ventricular remodeling. And you say, whoa, stop. The reason we do it is because multiple randomized trials have shown it improves survival, period.
Right,
you know,
right.
And what you're saying is perhaps the putative reason like behind why it improve survival, perhaps, you know, it's our best thinking as to the mechanistic way it works, but that's not the reason why we do it. The reason why we do it is that it works in sort of carefully done clinical trials. And I think that fallacy is present over and over in medicine. To some degree, it is necessary in the sense that, you know, all of us in medicine encounter cases that don't fit any clinical trials, and we have to at least come up with a stab for what we would do. And
right.
Inevitably we go back to those skills and we say, well, let me think about the biology. Let me think about how this works. And I think that's okay. That's a good way to generate hypotheses. But the danger comes when you don't check yourself, when you don't say, well, let me also remind myself that this is merely a hypothesis and that if this keeps happening over and over in my clinical practice, you know, I better be good about actually, you know, testing this in some robust way.
Right.
And I think, we subordinate, empirical science, top-down, you know, randomized trial science to basic methodological science. And I think that's behind a lot of these reversals.
Right. I feel like I've seen the same phenomenon happening in social sciences, but also things like evolutionary psychology, where, you know, an economist will have this theoretical model of human behavior, like a rational agent responding to incentives or signaling, or and evolutionary psychologists will have this, you know, model of adaptive traits and so on, they draw conclusions based on those models in almost a mechanistic way, and are not really that interested in sometimes or that moved by empirical or statistical results that contradict the theory. But I guess to be fair to doctors, like the science of physiology or of biology is at least somewhat more of a science than economics or evolutionary psychology, but maybe not as much more as people assume.
Yeah. So I guess, I think you're right on that, that people, you know, they get comfortable in the model and then they forget to say that the core of science is not to develop the model, but to push the model and ask, mm-hmm. well, if this model were true compared to other models, what's the testable question that would differentiate the two and to apply that test?
Right.
I think that's the hallmark of science. And in fact, actually, you know, one can make even a bigger argument, the way we teach science in, grade school, middle school, even my high school, you know, it's really not science. It's just sort sort of the rote memorization of models, and it's very rarely, you know, thinking about the experiments that proved one model, over another alternative. I think that was it, you know, not until for me in college really where we started to see that. But your question is about, I guess, to the core is, you know, is there some, you know, how robust is medical biological science? And
right.
I think, you know, there are certainly, you know, maybe tens of millions of papers in PubMed and millions of laboratory researchers doing work. And many things that do work do have very parsimonious and elegant basic science behind it. Many things that do work, also, we have very little idea how they even work at all. For instance, inhaled gases for anesthesia. Even to this day, we really don't know why they knock some people, you know, why they knock people out. Yet many of our cancer drugs are very sort of intelligently designed. Yet, you know, I think the more you study medical history, you just keep seeing the role of serendipity play in terms of, you know, a drug that you thought interrupted one, you know, protein. It was given randomly to a bunch of patients and some other people responded. And then later they started to look like, what was it about them that responded? And then they discovered a different protein it actually worked on. You know, that happens in the field of cancer research. And I think, you know, there've been many things that have happened that we really had strong pathophysiologic models that we got burned, and even in recent years. And, you know, we try to detail some of that. So I think that, yeah, even in medicine, which has a great evidence base, a basic science evidence base, you know, it still is not robust enough that you can skip those confirmatory studies.
So we're almost just about out of time for this section of the podcast, but I'll close with one more question just to bring things back to the pragmatic level. Talking to our listeners as patients, which, you know, we will all be at some point in our lives, do you have any advice for how we should be making health decisions for ourselves, you know, given this problem that you've detailed?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we make a strong case that probably the most important thing you can do is to find a doctor you trust whose maybe fundamental view of, you know, life and healthcare is sort of similar to your own view, or at least they get where you're coming from, they get your priorities and desires and goals, and they can work with you, and they're willing to work with you. So I think, you know, you find a doctor who you can ask a lot of questions for. And then, you know, if I were to make one very specific suggestion, it would go to, you know, the point of your last question, which is that patients like early medical students, they gravitate towards the nuts and bolts of how something should work. Oh, I have a fractured vertebral lesion, and you're going to go with a needle and inject medical grade cement, and it'll, you know, it'll increase the thickness of the bone. And but they should be asking the questions of what's the evidence behind it? How has it been tested? And that kind of shift from going from how does it work to what's the evidence for it, I think, is a very important shift.
Great. Well, we are all out of time, so I will wrap up this excellent conversation, and we'll move on now to the Rationally Speaking pick. Welcome back. Every episode, we invite our guest on Rationally Speaking to introduce the pick of the episode. That's a book or a website or something else that has shifted their thinking in an interesting way. So, Vinay, what's your pick for this episode?
So I think, you know, a book that I read in the last year that kind of really made me think differently about something was Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty.
And how did that give us the gist of what it's about, and then maybe you can explain how it influenced you.
Yeah, so I think, you know, Thomas Piketty is an economist who cares a lot about patterns of wealth over time, how money has been passed along from generation to generation. You know, for an economics book, it's actually gotten a sort of very broad reading, and I think it's very clearly readable for someone like myself who's not in the field. And I guess the thing I found very interesting about the book was, you know, he's done a lot of careful empirical work in terms of measuring throughout, you know, 18th century England and France, you know, how much money was passed along generation to generation, and how much money is earned in each generation. And I guess he has this very interesting quote in the book where he says something like, you know, some discussion in Voltaire where someone says, is it better to marry rich if you want to become rich, or is it better to have a job that pays you a lot of money? Mm-hmm. And the joke was, well, of course it's better to marry rich. You'll never earn that much money. Mm-hmm. And he asks, well, in what periods of society was that not the case? And it turns out it was very rarely not the case. For most of society, it was in fact true that the largest driver of wealth was inherited wealth and interest on capital. And I guess the reason it made me think a little bit differently is, you know, it makes you think about income taxation in the United States, and which is, you know, a progressive income tax, which I think is right. But it taxes income and it doesn't tax wealth. And those are kind of different things. And so there's, you know, and really the thing we want to sort of shift is wealth inequality, I think, in the long run. So, you know, it makes you think about whether or not there's some things we should be doing different from a tax perspective, even if you're a progressive like myself, that I had never thought about.
Excellent. Well, I had indeed, I'm well aware of this book because all the cool kids in my circles were toting it around this past year or so, and I keep meaning to pick it up. It's just sort of dauntingly dense, but I expect to really enjoy it, and I like very much endorse the empirical approach to history, which is a nice tie-in, nice tie-in to the theme of the episode, I guess. Great. Well, Vinay, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. And we're going to link to your pick, but also to your book, Ending Medical Reversal, which I, you know, highly endorse to all our listeners.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. Well, this concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.